From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Today's guest, author Cy Montgomery, writes that we are on the cusp of either destroying the sweet green earth or revolutionizing the way we understand the rest of animate creation. It's an important time to be writing about the connections we share with our fellow creatures, she adds, saying, it's a great time to be alive. In 31 books, including her latest, The Hawk's Way, she's made connecting with our fellow creatures her life's work and celebrated those connections. So more in a moment, but first, these messages.
Underwriting support from Color Blends, supplying top-quality spring-blooming Dutch flower bulbs to landscape professionals and ambitious home gardeners. More information on the web, colorblends.com. Programming and underwriting support from Royal Botanic Gardens, publishers of Kew Pocketbook, small gift books illustrated from Kew's vast collection of botanical art. The most recent book, Fungi, about the strange and singular world of mushrooms, toadstools, and their kin. In bookstores now.
In her 31 books for adults and children, Cy Montgomery has explored connections to a range of animals, not just obvious ones like dogs, but from tarantulas to octopuses, pigs, and more. In her just-out book, The Hawk's Way, it's the birds that she calls the tigers of the air, raptors, the birds of prey. I'm so glad to welcome her to the program today. Hi, Cy. Finally, we get to talk.
I know. I love this. Thanks so much.
Yeah. So before we get started, I'll say that with the transcript of this show over on awaytogarden.com, we'll have a book giveaway of your newest book, number 31. Is that right? Did I count right?
Well, you counted right on my website, but in reality, I haven't caught up with it. It's really, I think, 33 now.
Wow. You're a crazy woman. So good for you. But so we'll, at number 33, we'll have a book giveaway with the transcript, as I said, over on awaytogarden.com. So that'll be fun. And speaking of connection with our fellow creatures, you and I connected not long ago after I wrote a New York Times garden column about kind of books that comforted me in times, hard times like the world has been having, and books about nature and what I find, where I find solace in them. And yours were some of the books I mentioned, and you reached out. And so here we are. I mentioned then that one of my favorite of your books is the one called How to Be a Good Creature, which made me very happy when I read it years ago.
Oh, I'm so glad. And I also was, it was a huge compliment to be in the company of so many other terrific books that I too loved.
Oh yeah. Like I'm a crazy, you know, William Burroughs and Mae Sarton and so many, those are some of the older ones and some of the more contemporary ones. So yes, it was fun to be able to shout some of those out. So a theme of all your books is what animals teach us if we're receptive, if we're listening. Tell me some examples of some of the lessons learned or overall themes of some of your connections.
Well, one is just how amazing life is, that we as humans, although, you know, I don't mean to diss humans, I married a human, I have friends who are human, but we are only experiencing a small sliver of life. And if you know other species, animals like sharks who can sense the electrical heart, you know, electrical current in the heartbeats of their prey, or, you know, dogs and whales who can hear sounds that we don't, and creatures like dolphins and bats who can see with sound, and the many animals who see in detail that's almost unimaginable to us, such as hawks. Once you realize that they are experiencing this world in a far richer way than we are, the world becomes a little more accessible to us and more dazzling and more holy.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it makes us feel more at home on this earth. You know, if all of our friends were just, you know, white middle-class woman writers,
right,
our lives would be impoverished, you know?
Right.
I mean, even though I've lots of wonderful friends who fit that description. If we only ate chocolate ice cream, you know, we would soon be sick because we weren't getting a complete diet. And
right,
like that's the way so many of us are if we restrict ourselves to friendships with just the human species.
Yes. No, I completely agree. Now you've focused on the topic of birds in various works. Are you a birder or bird watcher or bird person or whatever? Is it just for your work, or do you go out birding? Or tell me about your relationship to birds before we get into hawk.
Well, I'm not a normal birder in that I don't go out, you know, ticking off species with my life list. But I've always loved birds because these are the wild animals that we commonly see every day, no matter where you live.
Yes.
So for a significant portion of my youth, I lived on an army base, and this is not exactly the wilds, but you were always seeing birds. And I had a parakeet when I was growing up, when I was little, and his name was Jerry. He was a beautiful green parakeet, and he was the first male ever to make love to me.
Oh,
I was like 7, and he threw up on my finger. I was, of course, enchanted, and I wasn't quite sure why he was throwing up on my finger, but I had the feeling that it was an act of generosity, and that he was, I kind of knew he was trying to feed me. I later knew that I later discovered that Conrad Lorenz had birds who adored him, jackdaws who adored him, and they expressed their adoration by puking up worms into his ears.
Oh!
They were just trying to feed him, and that was the only opening they could find.
Oh!
So what's not to love about somebody like that, right?
Right. And I love also that you point out something that I sort of had an epiphany about a million years ago, is that birds are an animal, one of the only animals I can really think of that, like us, are on two legs, are walking around, hopping around, walking around. They have two legs, they're bipeds,
yeah.
Right?
Yes.
So I feel that identification in a way, even though we have no wings,
and
they do, I feel, right. But I feel that sort of, hey, they have these two wet legs. And I always crack up when I'll see like a raven walking around the yard, or, you know, watch a hawk walk. I mean, you know, they strut around and.
Yeah, I love ravens. They look like they're holding they look like guys in black coats holding their hands behind their back as
yes.
they stride around in the courtyard, perhaps, of the university, you know?
Yes. So birds are also, as you point out in the book, they're sort of dinosaurs or descendants of dinosaurs. Tell us a little about that.
Yeah, I love this because one of the things that devastated me as a child was learning that dinosaurs were actually extinct. I didn't care that there was no Santa Claus or no tooth fairy, but the fact that the dinosaurs were gone, I just couldn't deal with it. But then I learned they aren't gone. Their descendants, their direct descendants, are at your bird feeder right now. They're eating worms off your lawn right now. And for those who eat meat at Thanksgiving, they're in the middle of your Thanksgiving table. And they are the direct descendants, not just of our friends like Brontosaurus and Diplodocus, you know, who walked around on 4 feet, but they are the direct descendants of the theropod dinosaurs, who were the meat eaters, Allosaurus, Tyrannosaurus Rex, Velociraptor. And that ferocity of those meat-eating dinosaurs you see when you look into the eyes of a hawk more clearly
yes.
than anywhere else.
Yes, you do indeed. You do indeed. And I remember years ago talking to the ornithologist Pete Dunn, who had written a book called Hawks in Flight, and expressing to him squeamishness about hawks like Cooper's hawks and Sharpshin hawks where I live, picking off songbirds at my feeder in winter, and how I felt guilty. I felt responsible. And he very patiently said to me, you know, Margaret, that hawk was going to eat the equivalent of that bird elsewhere. You just witnessed it, but you didn't cause it. Do you know what I mean? He was very
yes, exactly.
considerate. Like, this is, that is their diet, Margaret. It's not your fault.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, we all have free will. The hawks have free will and we have free will, but it's not within their free will to eat a broccoli.
No, it's not. No. So this book is mostly about sort of your experience learning to hunt with a hawk. So it's different from hawk watching in the fall or whatever during the migration. You write about their fierce, wild glory and that they're predators, not pets. And I think your husband characterized hunting with a bird of prey is like, you know, or having one is like having a loaded gun, you know, yes. present. So tell us about a little bit about that journey.
Yeah, a lot of people just thought, like, what, have you gone insane?
Yeah.
Many people think, you know, falconry is you have this cool looking bird on your glove, period. But that's not it. The bird doesn't care one way or another if it's on your glove. The reason the bird is going to stick around you is if you manage to convince that hawk that you're not going to do anything stupid and that you will be a useful junior hunting partner to them. And hunting is the last thing in the world that anyone who knows me would expect me to be doing.
Yeah, you're a vegetarian.
Years, I know, all you did was cut things into smaller and smaller pieces. You know, there were no impossible burgers then. But and just seeing a dead squirrel on the highway breaks my heart. And suddenly I found myself holding, you know, the heart of a baby chick in my falconry glove, trying to urge a Harris hawk out of a tree to land on my hand. So it was quite a transformation. And what happened with my heart was pretty much the minute I got up close and personal with the first Harris hawk I ever met, and her name was Jazz. One look into her eyes and I fell crazy in love with this incandescent wildness. This was like a ferocity with no evil in it. It was the wild incarnate. And I wanted what that bird wanted. I wanted desperately for her to experience her white hot happiness of doing what she was made to do.
Right.
Which was to hunt.
Right. You just said you looked into her eyes and their vision is incredible. Bird's vision is incredible. And you write about that too in The Hawk's Way.
Yeah, we're like, as primates, we depend on our vision a lot and our other senses are pretty lame. I mean, we don't smell hardly anything compared to what a lot of animals do. And our hearing is pretty sad, but we're proud of our eyesight, but we are like Mr. Magoo compared to a hawk from hundreds or thousands of feet in the air. They look down and they can see literally for miles and they see in detail what looks like just nothing to us. You know, when you're in an airplane and you look down on trees, you see like a bunch of broccoli, but they see all the individual leaves.
Wow.
And they see fast too. When we look at a hummingbird, we see a blur of wings, but they can see each wing beat. And they see colors that we can't imagine. Huh. And things probably have an iridescence to them that we don't see as well. So they are in this way gathering the world through their eyes, their huge eyes that weigh more than their brain. They are gathering more of life in this way than we can ever experience.
Yeah, you mentioned, I think, in the book also that the proportion, and I had never thought about this, but of course it's right, the proportionate sort of real estate that their eyes occupy on their heads compared to, say, ours is quite a lot larger percent, right? There's a more real estate for their vision.
Oh, yeah. An owl, for example. If we had eyes that are proportionally the same size in our head as an owl, our eyes would be the size of oranges.
Oh my goodness. Right. Exactly. And yeah, unimaginably large.
Be a lot cool, of wouldn't it?
Yeah. A lot of power in those. And of course, with something like an owl, many of whom hunt at night, you know, there's that extra special. I'm totally, and this is a complete digression, but I'm totally fascinated by creatures of the night and the special aspects of vision, the special elements of the physical of the eye and how it can see at night and all of that equipment, so to speak, that we don't have. That's another form of vision that we don't have that many creatures on the night shift do have, including tiny insects.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And like we were talking about earlier, night is half of existence and we know so little of it.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Yeah. No, until I started watching moths, maybe 10, 12 years ago, I had never really, I had no idea who was on the night shift in my own garden. And yet I knew the place so well, I thought, but I didn't know half its creatures.
I know. And they're so beautiful.
And many, right. And they, many of them, they're creatures of the night because they're, it's an anti, it's a primary anti-predation device is to, you know, lurk around in the darkness, right. And not get seen. Yeah. So it's like, there's a lot going on out there.
Oh God, I love moths. We have a caterpillar lab. Not
yes,
far from us.
Yes, their I know.
Moths
sure.
are celebrated. And, you know, people think, oh, they're just sitting around eating your sweaters. Well, no.
No, not at all.
Fabulous creature.
Not at all. And speaking of birds, they're also feeding birds because a lot of birds, especially songbirds, depend on the production of caterpillars from moth species to feed their young and fledge their, you know, fledge a healthy, you know, family each spring. That's caterpillar is baby food, right?
That's right. And so birds, birds are the gardener's friend, right?
Yeah. Yeah. In many ways, in many ways. Yeah. So what is, I mean, I was wondering if like the one lesson from you're going hunting with a hawk on your glove and all this stuff, and you're luring it to your back to your glove with these tempting gross treats for those of us who are vegetarian of animal parts and so forth. Is one of the lessons that you kind of alluded to this before, that you're not in charge, that this is the hawk's mission. This is the, do you know what I mean?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. And I think this is something that we humans need to learn over and over and over. We need to respect the others and not feel like we have to be the boss all the time. Because when we think we're the boss, what do you end up with? Global climate change and an ocean that has more plastic than fish.
Right.
So yeah, let's be reminded that we can take a back seat. And if so, then we can touch some of the knowledge of these other creatures. We can step aside and let their powers lead us, and then we are open to their lessons and their ways and their wisdom.
Right. And you're not doing it because, like, you write that a hawk isn't going to love you back, right?
Yes. And that too is very liberating. You know, so many of the relationships that we have in this world are fundamentally transactions. You know, I mean, It's true, of course, you love your spouse and your children and your friends, but you do expect something in return.
Right.
Well, with a hawk, they're not going to love you back in the way that we expect. They're not going to comfort you when you're sad or come to your aid when you need it. But what they'll let you do is witness their glory and be humbled before it. Mm. And that is a huge and holy blessing.
Mm. The only time I was ever, I mean, I have them here all the time in the garden, and sometimes they come, sometimes like a juvenile Cooper's hawk or whatever will kind of strut up to the back. I have a glass door on the back porch, and they'll see a reflection, you know, and they'll strut up and they'll like look at who's in the mirror, so to speak, yeah. You know, that kind of thing. So sometimes I see them up close that way, but the closest I've ever engaged with a hawk was at New England Falconry, Chris Davis's place,
yeah.
And you know, went to fly a hawk, not hunt, but just fly, you know, and put the glove on and the whole that whole thing, and they're very heavy for a bird.
Yes. Yes, and when they fly and smack on your glove, the force with which they hit your glove, weren't you surprised at that?
I was, because of course I think of birds as like, you know, featherweights, haha.
Right. You know, they are. They are. Their feathers weigh more than their skeletons in most species.
Wow.
And they're made of air. They've got all these air sacs and giant lungs and a big old heart. You know, they're mostly air. And yet when a hawk lands on your arm, something substantial has happened.
Right. Right. So ultimately, I don't think you decided to have a hawk that lived at your place that was your hawk for hunting. Is that correct?
That is correct. I had chickens at the time, mm-hmm. and the hawk would definitely kill the chickens. The other thing was I travel a lot for my work.
Right.
And who would take care of this hawk? Well, my husband, who didn't want to do it. So I stuck with my marriage and my chickens. But you know what happened, which is amazingly cool, is that just last year, a dear friend of ours moved to Hancock, and he's a master falconer.
Oh, how funny.
He came with his young hawk, Mahood. So now right on my street, I have a friend with a hawk who I know pretty well, and we can fly together anytime we want.
Huh, that's amazing. So in the last couple few minutes that we have, I have to confess some jealousy to some of the other animals you've met. Octopus. Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
That must have been one of the wackiest ones.
Well, you would think, you know, because we're so distantly related. The last common ancestor we had was 500 million years ago.
Yes.
When everybody was a tube. And you would not think that you could make friends with someone that different, someone with no bones and who can taste with all of their skin and whose mouth is in their armpits. But I found that with every octopus that I've gotten to know, that octopus has clearly recognized me. I'm not projecting. They have done studies on this, and we know octopuses will recognize individual humans, even if they're dressed identically. And the octopus would choose to leave its lair to come over just to play with you.
Right. Yeah, there was a documentary not long ago, a couple of years maybe. I can't remember the name of it right now, but.
Was it My Octopus Teacher?
Yes. And
yes,
you know,
wasn't that great?
Yes, because I had read your book and then I watched that, and I was just like, oh my goodness. I mean,
yeah, that guy is terrific. And he actually was free diving without a tank, without oxygen.
Yes.
In really cold kelp forest.
Yes.
Which I mean, first of all, the kelp forest is on the other side of the country. And even if it was outside my house, I probably could not physically do what he did. And boy, was he lucky, though, because, he was brave, he was strong, he was smart, he was creative, but he was also very lucky because that octopus did not get eaten during the year or so that he knew her. Mm. And that is the fate of most octopuses, is to get eaten. In a tank at an aquarium like New England Aquarium, I had the luxury of knowing I would find my octopus friend every day.
Right.
And she knew that she would see me. And I think she looked forward to seeing me as much as I looked forward to seeing her, maybe for different reasons. But her curiosity about me was just evident. It was extremely clear. She was very curious. And she's very smart. And she liked that I was different. And I liked that she was different. And I think we both kind of came at this relationship with kind of, well, what is it like to be you? I want to know.
Hmm. Well, that's actually a really good question for us to approach any connection with another organism, another creature, isn't it? That question.
Yes, and each other.
Yeah. No, good. Well, so many other millions of questions I could ask you are virtually out of time. And I want to remind everybody that we're going to have a book giveaway of Cy Montgomery's 33rd, not 31st book, The Hawk's Way, with the transcript of the show. And I'm so glad to finally speak to you. I'm glad that little funny mention ended up bringing us together, because we have many friends in common, many writer friends and so forth. And so it was about time.
Yeah, I'm so grateful. Thank you so much.
All right. I hope I'll talk to you again soon. Thank you.
I would love that.
Programming and underwriting support from Royal Botanic Gardens, publishers of Kew Pocketbook Small Gift Books Illustrated from Kew's vast collection of botanical art. The most recent book, Fungi, about the strange and singular world of mushrooms, toadstools, and their kin. In bookstores now. Underwriting support from Color Blends, supplying top-quality spring-blooming Dutch flower bulbs to landscape professionals and ambitious home gardeners. More information on the web, colorblends.com.
And thanks to all of you for tuning in, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening and looking at birds meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.